you will please open up to Ezra chapter 7. We are returning to Ezra after a long time away from him, working our way through Haggai and Zechariah and Esther. Coming back now to our original foundation book there of the book of Ezra. We'll be looking at all four of the last chapters this evening. Should be fairly easy for us to conclude the book, chapter 7 through 10, in the book of Ezra. I've been showing you several different pictures from a moment in time on the last trip when we were on the Western Walls. That's not the one you think of as the Wailing Wall. That Western Wall is at the Temple Mount. This is a half a mile away from there to the west. It is the exterior wall of Jerusalem itself. I've been using these just as a means of kind of giving us some sort of semblance of rebuilding efforts that are going on in Ezra's day. We'll be seeing what is much more like these sorts of structures when we get to Nehemiah, which will be starting next week. But this was the very picture that I showed you last week, and I mentioned that this structure right here is thought perhaps to have been the place where Jesus was presented and faced his trial with Pilate there. But as I was looking at this picture, you know, I've noticed that even though you have a lot of people in the picture, it's hard to really see the scale of these walls still. So this next shot that I'm going to give you, I had walked over onto the grass about right here and took a more straight-on view of that same location. And so now you can see one of the professors, whose name I've forgotten now, from Florida College, is standing there on top of those same steps. And look at how tall those walls are. They were, in the time of Jesus, apparently higher yet, even more impressive. So as you recall, these were built and finished in 1541. Suleiman the Magnificent, as he's called, and have stood now for 500 years. But Ezra has been telling us about a period of time in the first six chapters in which the Jews are not building a wall, but they have returned. He speaks of their first return from the 70 years exile. They and begun then the laying of a foundation for the second temple. They're going to rebuild after Nebuchadnezzar's destruction of that temple. But the people apparently got distracted, both by opposition from the nations around them, let's say, and also in building their own houses and all of that. Maybe got a little bit just too lackadaisical. And so Haggai and Zechariah were called to stimulate them. So I've been showing you this chart, and we'll be again, as we're going to be getting into Nehemiah in a minute, next week, but I've been showing you this chart and wanted you to just be refreshed again where we are. Ezra's is a unique book. It is split at the end of chapter 6 until you get to chapter 7. Right in there, there's about 60 years. So we looked at the first six chapters. We saw then how the people got lackadaisical. So we looked at Haggai's little two-chapter book, looked at Zechariah, very difficult apocalyptic literature, we call it 14 chapters. And then we turned to the book of Esther last week and covered the entirety of that book, this fascinating birth of the Feast of Purim, as it's called, as an attempted genocide was a plot hatched by Haman and, of course, wound up upon his own gallows. But you can see already that if the sixth chapter ends in the vicinity of 516 B.C., when that temple is finally completed, so they now have a fully functional temple back in Jerusalem, thanks to the preaching of these two men. Esther's book here is 483 to 473. So we're looking at 516 plus, let's say, the 17 years here. You know, there's 34 years just between those two books. And so Esther's book lies between chapter 6 and 7, about 34 years after chapter 6 had ended. Ezra's last four chapters, in my Bible, I've written 458 A.D. This chart happens to use 457. But anyway, that these last four chapters only deal with that 1 year. So it's an unusual book that the first six chapters cover about 20 years. Then there's this big gap, and we have Esther, and she's dealing, you know, with just a couple of events in her life. Then we come back to the last four chapters of Ezra, and we're going to look at a single year. Look at a major problem, though. Before then, we'll be turning to the book of Nehemiah. Now, I didn't highlight it, but you can see Malachi right here. And so this chart is one of my more favorite charts, I guess, because what it's showing you, this one and the next one that I'm about to introduce, is showing you how we have the passage of some 200 years that are the last 200 years in which you have biblical record of God's people in the form of these books, Ezra, Esther, and Nehemiah, which are pure history books. And then the two prophets, Haggai and Zechariah, before finally at the end we're going to come to Malachi. And then we have that period of silence, the intertestamental period, sometimes called the period, maybe most often, the period between the testaments, but it's the years of silence. So if you say roughly, we've got 520 over here, we're going to have 420 down here. These books are spanning 200 years, and then 400 years in which the Jews themselves to this day will say, we never had another prophet. There wasn't any revelation from God from about 400 B.C., of course, till the time of John the Baptist. So now, what I want to do, though, is highlight, and you probably only can barely see it, but I haven't been mentioning it because it's a little too small print and all that, that on this chart, you've got a big number one right here, number two way down here, and then a number three. These are the three returns from the Babylonian captivity. Now, here's a kind of a trick question, sort of a twofold trick, but how many years are there in the Babylonian captivity? 70. How many times did Nebuchadnezzar invade Israel?
Three.
And then I keep saying, I've been telling you, but we'll look at it in more detail in just a minute, we have these three returns. Do the three times that Nebuchadnezzar invaded and then finally destroyed the temple perfectly correlate with the three returns so that we have 70 years between each one? That's the trick question. And that's what I'm always trying to, you know, to help people to remember. These are profoundly important days. So, what is the year of the first invasion of Nebuchadnezzar?
606.
Thank you. It's pretty easy. Nice round numbers. 606. 70 years after that is 536. 536 is this return number one, which the first six chapters of Ezra tell us about, but Ezra's not involved in them. He's writing, if he's the author, long after the fact. Who is the governor and the leader of the first return exactly 70 years after 606 in 536? Who is that leader? Starts with a Z. That's Zerubbabel. So, here's that first one, and that's where they immediately lay the foundation, but it's going to take them 20 years to finish because they get distracted. This second one is this one year that we're going to talk about in the last four chapters of Ezra. 458, use 457 if you prefer. This is Ezra's return. Ezra is the leader. Ezra is our hero in these last four chapters. Ezra is the man of the hour. But, as I just said, you know, there's about 60 years that lie between these two. Did I get that up already? Okay, here we go. Let's show you how. So this is a brand new chart. It's put out by the same people, of course, as you can see. This one is entitled The Times of Ezra, Nehemiah, and Esther, using the biblical order of the book, but not the chronological order, for the title there. But what this does, it shows you the whole overview again of these 70 years of captivity, and then a little more detail on these three returns. So I'm not going to give you a test. I'm not going to, you know, demand a lot about this. But the more I just repeat it, the more likely you are to have some real big mileposts in biblical history. So we're going to zoom in on just that part of the chart right there. So it's the same chart, just expanded to the 70-year Jewish captivity. Three stages of captivity. What are the 3 days? 606, 597, and 586.
There's exactly 70 years from the first invasion in 606 to the first return. 586 is the destruction of the temple. Is there a 70-year correlation there? Yes, it's exactly 70 years to 516 when they finally finished rebuilding it. So while there are three exiles and three returns, the three returns do not all perfectly match the three exiles. But two of those capturing events, you know, exiles, do have a 70-year correlation. One of them does not. Now, one other thing I wanted to add here, we did not study Jeremiah's enormous book, gigantic book. And of course, he wrote the little book of Lamentations as well. But Jeremiah's prophecies begin before that invasion in 606, and his life is going to span right up to about the middle of Daniel and Ezekiel's lives. Daniel is taken captive in number one, number two, or number three Babylonian invasion. Which is it? Number one. Ezekiel is taken captive in what invasion? Number two at 597. No 70-year correlation to anything in the middle one and that one. But just know these are the two, you know, time frames. Daniel taken captive first. He'll spend his entire life there. He'll live to see the Medo-Persians come on the scene. He'll live to see Babylon fall. He'll be a high-ranking authority in the Medo-Persian Empire, just like he was in the Babylonian Empire. Very, very, very important individual. And then Daniel is, you know, in the court. He's in the royal court, and he's the king's advisor. What is Ezekiel's role, which we've also not studied, the prophecy itself? Who are the people he's working with? These are the Israelites themselves, his countrymen. So while the one is occupying this position of tremendous power and influence, Daniel, Ezekiel is you know, your common man, working with the common man. He's a man of the people, we might say. So these are our three exile times on the return. So this is that previous chart again. You can see one, two, three, three returns. And we're going to now expand that much of the chart right here. And then, this is probably the last time I'll spend much time on it, but I just want to see more detail here. Return number one covers how many chapters in the book of Ezra?
Six.
The first six chapters. I tried to put my head in the way. Is my head not big enough?
Okay.
So that's where that fits. Exactly 70 years after the 606. So look at this now. If that's, you know, 536, this second one over here that we're going to talk about, the last four chapters of Ezra tonight, that's not until 458. And then the third one won't be until Nehemiah that we'll start studying next week. So what you've got is 60 years between chapter 6 and chapter 7 in Ezra's book. And in those 60 years, first you've got Zechariah and Haggai in the early part. You got Esther, it takes place, you know, right in the middle. And finally, we're coming back to Ezra again. We're going to be dealing with a return from Babylonian captivity in 458. But it doesn't correlate to 70 years of any of the exiles. And then we'll come to Nehemiah, and he'll be another 13 years later, and no correlation there either. So I know this is always difficult stuff, but I hope that if I just keep putting it in front of you, you know, at least you'll see that truly starting with Nebuchadnezzar in 606, you're looking at what is the last phase of God dealing with those Jews at all. First, in 606, 597, 586, he has had it with these people. He's warned them through Isaiah and a host of other prophets. They will not listen. They then have to be punished, and they're punished with a 70-year captivity. So then, though, they come back, and Ezra's book, and along with Nehemiah's, will be our primary historical record. Esther just tells about her own life there, but these men, Ezra and Nehemiah, are going to span these last 200 years, and Ezra is going to have a 60-year hole in the middle of his book.
So tonight, it should be very easy. We're going to do exactly like we did with Esther. I'm just going to pick certain verses in the course of a given chapter. It's very easy. We've got lists of names and numbers and stuff, you know, we can pass over very quickly. So we're not having trouble finishing Ezra tonight. But let's turn now to chapter 7 and get out your pencils, you know, and make some notes. There's this 60-year gap between that last chapter and here. So if you'd like, at verse 1, if you got room, after these things, in the reign of Artaxerxes, king of Persia. The reign of Artaxerxes is from 464 to 423 B.C. He's going to reign for 21 years. Ezra is going to be concerned with Artaxerxes. So it's 464 to 423 B.C. That Ezra, son of Sariah, son of Azariah, son of Ilkiah, and son of all these other guys, clear down through verse 5, this Ezra, verse 6, went up from Babylon. He was a scribe skilled in the law of Moses, which the Lord God of Israel had given, and the king granted him all he requested, because the hand of the Lord his God was upon him. Make your note at verse 6. It's 458 B.C. 458. This Ezra comes up from Babylon. And again, it's fascinating, and again, we wish we knew more about it, and again, we are told that the hand of God is involved in this, but isn't it more than a little interesting that you have this man, yet another of these people that are just slaves in captivity? And as far as Ezra goes, we don't know. We know virtually nothing about the man. We don't know how old he was. We don't know if he was born in captivity or anything about him. So, you know, I haven't got any clues in those regards. But somehow, already at verse 6, what do we learn about him? Number one, he was a, what's the title ascribed to his job description? He's a scribe. Number two, he's skilled in what? The law of Moses. That's the law that the Lord God of Israel had given. And the king granted him what? All that he requested. So somehow, we have a very intelligent academic. This man's a scribe, and he's skilled in the law. So even during all these years of captivity, and not only to 70, but even later, all these years later, 100 years later, what do we have about the law? Is it still intact? Is it still being studied? And except that they can't offer any sacrifices in Medo-Persia, is it still being practiced? To some extent, they have this amazing freedom. How all that develops, we don't have any clue except the statement that the king granted him all he requested because, in the verse 6, the hand of the Lord his God was what? Upon him. God picks his people. God places his people. God then uses his people for his purposes. Ezra clearly is a man of God. And he'd be in very difficult circumstances. Apparently he's never seen a temple in his life. He's never been to Jerusalem. Doesn't know any of these things. And still, he's a master of Moses' law, 1,000 miles away in this captivity. You know, and yet high office, and now coming home. I'm sorry, yeah, Bill was.
Okay, according to the genealogy here, he's one of the descendants of Aaron. So aren't all of Aaron's descendants priests?
Well, the direct answer, I think, is no, not all of his descendants were priests. If one he had a physical deformity or something, there'd be a variety of reasons why one couldn't serve as a priest. But that is the family of the high priesthood, yes. Okay, so yeah. Pardon me. Ezra is certainly a priest. We're going to find that out. You know, we did find out that Ezra is a priest. And so he's going to be, he is therefore skilled in the law of Moses. You know, he's a guy who has priestly lineage. Okay, thank you.
Anymore.
That's correct. And that's the amazing thing, that in captivity they still could. The Messiah hadn't come yet. We need that lineage for the lion from the tribe of Judah to come. But then after 70 AD, and as if that wasn't enough, again in the Bar Kokhba revolt of 135 AD, those genealogical records were destroyed on two different occasions. The great majority of them, you know, in the conflagration of Jerusalem in 70 AD. And then whatever else they, you know, had managed to try to preserve and keep had then been destroyed a second time when they did the second revolt in 135. So that's absolutely correct. Okay, so now we've read verse 1 and verse 6. Let's finish 7 through 10 in chapter 7. Some of the sons of Israel and some of the priests, the Levites, the singers, the gatekeepers, the temple servants, went up to Jerusalem in the seventh year of King Artaxerxes. So again, that's 458 BC. That's how we get the date. In 8, he came to Jerusalem in the fifth month, which was in the seventh year of the king. 4, on the first of the first month, he began to go up from Babylon. And on the first of the fifth month, he came to Jerusalem because the good hand of his God was upon him. Now, you've just learned how long it takes to travel 1,000 miles from what is now the Medo-Persian Empire back home to Jerusalem. How long exactly does it take? 4 months. 4 full months to the day. So they're on this journey for 4 months. Next comes verses 11 through 28. So skip down 11. This is the copy of the decree which King Artaxerxes gave to Ezra the priest, the scribe, learned in the words of the commandments of the Lord and his statutes to Israel. Now, if you will, make another note. It's not real critical, and you know I point these things out, but it's not like they're going to change anything big. But just like with Daniel, and apparently for the same reasons, starting with verse 12, we switch from Hebrew to Aramaic. So I just drew a line between 11 and 12, and I wrote, begin Aramaic. And then you go down to the end of verse 26. The decree from Artaxerxes is in his native language. So Ezra has this decree. It's his get-out-of-jail-free card. It's his building permit. It's his pass. But it's in Aramaic, and he's going to carry it then to the Aramaic servants and royal officials, the satraps of Medo-Persia as now being run by Artaxerxes. So just to note that verses 12 through 26 are written in Aramaic, and then we come back to the Hebrew again. So here's the decree in 13. I've issued a decree that any of the people of Israel and their priests and the Levites in my kingdom who are willing to go to Jerusalem may go with you. For as much as you are sent by the king and his seven counselors to inquire concerning Judah and Jerusalem according to the law of your God, which is in your hand. So the king, it says in 14, is sending you, as you are sent by the king and his seven counselors to inquire concerning Judah and Jerusalem according to the law of your God, which is in your hand. Now, I think we'll get an answer to that kind of mysterious sentence right there. Why in the world would the king do this? But Artaxerxes felt it was imperative that he find a Jew. This is obviously not just any Jew. Ezra is of priestly descent. He's still got those genealogical records. It's listed at the start of chapter 7. He's a scribe. He's skilled in the law of Moses. This is the man that Artaxerxes picks. And I want you to go in verse 14 and inquire concerning Judah and Jerusalem according to what? According to the law of your God, which is in your hand. So apparently, what is Ezra also bringing with him back to Israel and especially Jerusalem, along with this letter from the king? What's he also got? He's got a copy of the law, the very one apparently he spent his life studying. So he's returning with it now. But Artaxerxes wants Ezra the priest to go 1,000 miles out there to Jerusalem and inquire in verse 14, inquire concerning Judah and Jerusalem according to the law. He sees that law of those Jews as being important. He will learn in a little bit, I think, very much wants that law to be properly obeyed in Jerusalem. He's sending a master and an expert and a priest in Ezra to go back there and find out, are the Jews in Judah and Jerusalem living their lives according to the copy of the law that you're carrying with you, Ezra? Now just hold that for a second. We'll get to the reason why at the end of the letter. But it's very curious. You know, at the start you say, well, why would he even care? What's the deal here? Well, hold that thought. So in 14, for as much as you are sent by the king and his seven counselors to inquire concerning Judah and Jerusalem according to the law of your God which is in your hand, and to bring the silver and gold which the king and his counselors have freely offered to the God of Israel, whose dwelling is in Jerusalem. The king and his counselors have what? Freely offered silver and gold to whom? The God of Israel. He's showing significant respect to the God of Israel, whose dwelling is in Jerusalem, with all the silver and gold which you shall find in the whole province of Babylon, along with the freewill offering of the people and of the priests, who offered willingly for the house of their God, which is in Jerusalem. With this money, therefore, you shall diligently buy bulls, rams, and lambs with their grain offerings and their libations, and offer them on the altar of the house of your God, which is in Jerusalem. This particularly surprises me. Apparently, Ezra and Artaxerxes have been spending some time together. And here's Artaxerxes writing in his letter the animals that need to be purchased so they can be sacrificed, and the altar of the house of God and its location, free will offerings as well as offerings that were not free will. He's shown a lot of respect for this God. So in 18, now whatever seems good to you and your brothers to do with the rest of the silver and gold, you may do according to the will of your God. Also the utensils which are given to you for the service of the house of your God, deliver in full before the God of Jerusalem. The rest of the needs for the house of your God, for which you may have occasion to provide, provide for it from the royal treasury. And I, even I, King Artaxerxes, issue a decree to all the treasurers who are in the provinces beyond the river, that whatever Ezra the priest, the scribe of the law of the God of heaven, may require of you, it shall be done diligently, up to 100 talents of silver, 100 cords of wheat, 100 baths of wine, 100 baths of oil. Salt is needed. Whatever is commanded by the God of heaven, let it be done with zeal for the house of the God of heaven, lest, and in the next few words, you get all the explanations, and it comes clear as crystal. What is on Artaxerxes' mind? He does not want the God of these Jews over there in Jerusalem to what? Be mad at him. Okay? He's just living in fear, is all it is. Lest there be wrath against the kingdom of the king and his sons. And we've already seen this before in Ezra. So, for a second time, what did we learn about these foreign kings in the Medo-Persian Empire? It wasn't so with Nebuchadnezzar and the Babylonians. It wasn't so with the Assyrians. But it is now with these Medo-Persians. They had what sort of feelings toward other people's gods? Superstitious respect. They fear. And they wanted to do everything they could to give all of the idolaters as well as these Jews the freedom to practice their religion in the hope that this polytheistic society believed in many gods would not get crossways with any god. They're thinking in terms of multiple gods, and the multiple gods, this multiplicity, is based on geographic power. This god has power there, this god has power here, this god has power someplace else. Each god has a location. So the king does not want to upset any area's god when he is the king over that area. It's going to disrupt the taxes. It's going to mean people have to die in war. It's going to cost me a fortune, you know, having to field this army and feed them and all the rest of that. So it's a smart policy from a polytheistic idolater's viewpoint. You know, make peace with everybody. Bill.
Something else, too. Now, this has been 60 years since the first return.
Yes.
Okay, when Darius and Cyrus sent the first return back with money and stuff.
Same thing.
And his good wishes. It's been 60 years and all of what he set out to do has not been completed.
Well, see, that's the next thing I was
seeing that this needs to be done.
Well, that's the next thing I was going to bring up is that the temple has been built. That's all done, been done for 40 years now. And so there's a fully functional temple there. But now you have to read between the lines. And that's a great question. It's a great observation. Is he thinking that they're not doing it right? I'm not sure that that's the case. But we don't have enough to really answer the question. You know, we know he doesn't want wrath against his kingdom or his sons. Let's all rule in peace. So we know that. But beyond that, we're not told if he thinks that the Jews are failing somehow or if he's just curious. It does say inquire. I kind of lean toward he's just curious. He didn't just quite understand it. So he sends a Jewish expert out there to evaluate it with all kinds of money to make sure that you're doing it right. But I don't know if we can go so far as to say he was criticizing them, you know, and saying you guys didn't pass the test.
That wasn't what I meant.
Yeah.
He said to buy all the materials and stuff to do this work. That work hadn't been completed yet.
Well, yeah, it had. The temple's fully functional. But he's just ensuring that it stays that way. You know, I can't say that he feels like there's work undone. He's just saying, inquire and make sure that it is. And here's all the money you would need. What was the actual statement? 18, whatever seems good to you and to your brothers to do with the rest, you may do according to the will of your God. So he's writing a blank check. Just go make sure everything's, you know, fully functional, because I don't want that God to be mad at me. But yeah, that's about all I can do for you. We really just don't have enough data to kind of read his mind there. Okay, so utensils as well. And then we have 24. We also inform you that it's not allowed to impose tax, tribute, or toll on any of the priests, Levites, singers, doorkeepers, Nethinim, or servants. Notice this familiarity. What's going on there? Servants of this house of God. And you, Ezra, according to the wisdom of your God, which is in your hand, appoint magistrates and judges that they may judge all the people who are in the province beyond the river, even all those who know the laws of your God, and you may teach anyone who's ignorant of them. Just go do your thing. Carte blanche. Now, I might point out, we still to this day can't figure out what river he had in mind either. Does he mean the Euphrates or does he mean the Jordan? And we've had this problem with other kings, beyond the river. There are times when, beyond all doubt, we have this expression beyond the river, and it's the Euphrates. In this case, I rather lean toward the Jordan, because the Jews and the temple and the need, therefore, for priests and bulls and rams and cores of wheat and all of this, that all of that is only needed in one place. And where's that place? Jerusalem. Now, the Jews and their promised land flowing with milk and honey and all of that was from the far eastern Medo-Persian Empire, would be beyond what river? What's the border of the Jews? See, that's the Jordan River. And so in this case, I really think it's the Jordan that he has in mind, because everything that he's talking about is only going to function back in the Jews' homeland there, and particularly in Jerusalem. But in 26, whoever will not observe the law of your God and the law of the king, let judgment be executed upon him strictly, whether for death or for banishment or for confiscation of goods or for imprisonment. End Aramaic. Apparently, therefore, end of letter and end of Artaxerxes' words. It's kind of an abrupt transition. It's part of the reason I have you write end of the Aramaic. Because when it now says, "Blessed be the Lord, the God of our fathers, who has put such as this in the king's heart to adorn the house of the Lord which is in Jerusalem, and has extended loving kindness to me before the king and his counselors, before all the king's mighty princes. Thus I was strengthened according to the hand of the Lord my God upon me." That's a third time we've been told that. "And I gathered leading men from Israel to go up with me." So the last two verses of chapter 7 are Ezra's doxology. He offers praise to God. "Blessed be the God who put all of this into Artaxerxes' head. Look at how wondrous this is." Now, to what extent, this would kind of go along with what Bill was saying a moment ago, to what extent Ezra has been in this king's head, you know, we can't tell. But obviously there's some kind of contact, and it looks to be pretty much between the two. So the king has learned, and maybe Ezra's counseling him, coaxing, you know, him in this letter on how to write it and getting specifics, so that with this letter now, he's going to have all this money and no taxes to boot, and going to be able to get exactly everything he wants. But by the time Ezra's done with him, Artaxerxes has got a pretty clear picture of all this, and a purely selfish reason. He is not a worshiper of Jehovah God. What's the only thing he wants? "Jehovah God, please leave me and my boys alone." Okay, it's really all he's got. It's like a giant bribe, really, is what it is. Okay, so Artaxerxes is ruling from 464 to 423 BC. Ezra's returning in 458. And if you have this proper attitude like as Ezra had, then what three times has this chapter suggested? God will see that you succeed. God will help. So it gives us, you know, that encouragement. Just be faithful to your God. Have that proper devotion. And then God will be on your side. Now, let's go to chapter 8. Now, chapter 8 is a lot easier than that other one just because of these lists. So if you look at verse 1, "These are the heads of the fathers and the genealogical enrollment of those who went up with me from Babylon in the reign of Artaxerxes." So, okay, all the way down through 13. At verse 14, I'd have you make a note. We have our first subtotal. It's not a complete total, but there is a subtotal. The sons of Bigvai, Uthai, Zabud, and 70 males with them. 15, "Now I assembled them at the river." So you end that list. That list is different from the one that's about to follow. So if you want the subtotal, in verses 1 through 14, we have a grand total of 1,515 men. Women are not numbered. Kids are not numbered. But the total of these people who are of the genealogical enrollment that went up with me from Babylon, 1,515 at verse 14. Now read 20 through 23. We'll get our second subtotal and a grand total. So in 20, 220 of the temple servants whom David and the princes had given for the service of the Levites, all of them designated by name. Well, I'm going to stop right there for just a minute. These are ministers. These are Levites. He has started inquiring at verse 15. Well, we got all these guys going, but we need Levites too. So where are they? So they did a search. And these ministers right here are 258. Again, astonishing. We're 100 years after the captivity. And what are we looking at? People who have carefully guarded their records, are carefully trying to obey them insofar as they can, and who have carefully then kept genealogical records to know who the priests are. So, adding 258 to 1515, the grand total of the men and an unknown number of women and children, the grand total at verse 20 is 1,772. So Ezra's return is not gigantic, but it's pretty substantial. It's 1,772 men and then some number of wives and children that would have gone along with them. So figure, there's probably about, what, 2,500, 3,000, wild guesses as all those are. That's, you know, that's kind of an army, but you got women and children carrying a lot of gold and silver, you know, and so you're going to be real concerned about protection. We got a whole lot of money. and we're going to go 1,000 miles through all these territories where it's their home field advantage. So Ezra's very concerned about this. In 21, I proclaimed a fast there at the river of Ahava that we might humble ourselves before our God to seek from Him a safe journey for us, our little ones, and all our possessions. For I was ashamed to request from the king troops and horsemen to protect us from the enemy on the way, because we had said to the king, the hand of our God is favorably disposed to all those who seek Him, but His power and His anger are against all those who forsake Him. So we fasted and sought our God concerning this matter, and He listened to our entreaty. And that, again, I don't know quite how much to make out of that, but it does sound like an interesting little insight into Ezra's heart. Ezra had made a big show of his faith before his God. And then what? Then he got to worrying about it, didn't he? Oh, wait a minute. Well, I did that, and so now I can't go to the king. So what are we going to do? We're going to go to the king. We're going to go and fast, and we're going to beseech him for protection. Lord, I promise, the king, here we go. Please let it happen.
Do you recall the movie or the video that you showed us about the trek from Israel to these captivity sites?
Okay, yes.
How terribly difficult it was.
Yeah, I do remember that video. It's what's it called? Something grass. I forget what it is now. At any rate, I'm glad you appreciated it. I found it endlessly fascinating. These people are on foot, often barefoot, and climbing mountains, and herding sheep and goats and fording rivers and all the rest of that, And so it was, Donna, what's the name of that video? You know the one I'm talking about? It's got the word grass in it, but I can't remember. What's Ruskin is, anyhow. Fascinating documentary on people in the same region. Okay, so it is. It's a very difficult, very dangerous from robbers, very dangerous anyway, journey. So we fasted and prayed. Now in 31 through 36, we'll bring this chapter to a close. In 31, we journeyed from the river Ahava on the 12th of the first month to go to Jerusalem. The hand of our God was over us. He delivered us from the hand of the enemy and the ambushes by the way. So did they have problems on the way? Sounds like it. He delivered us. Does not necessarily mean we didn't have any. It just means we, survived them. We succeeded. And so in 32, thus we came to Jerusalem and remained there 3 days. On the fourth day, the silver and the gold and the utensils were weighed out in the house of our God into the hand of Meremoth, the son of Uriah the priest. And with him was Eleazar, the son of Phinehas. With him were the Levites, Jozabad, the son of Jeshua, Noadiah, the son of Binui. Everything was numbered and weighed. All the weight was recorded at the time. The exiles who had come from the captivity offered burnt offerings to the God of Israel, 12 bulls for all Israel, 96 rams, 77 lambs, 12 male goats for sin offering, all as a burnt offering to the Lord. Now, again, remembering Solomon when he dedicated his temple, it was tens of thousands of animals, remember? So this is really a small event. But I'm sure it would be most welcome to the people in Jerusalem, and so more Israelites are building our country. So in 36, they delivered the king's edicts to the king's satraps, hence Aramaic letter to Aramaic people, and to the governors of the provinces beyond the river, and they supported the people and the house of God. Now, I found it interesting, and I highlighted it myself, but starting back in chapter 7, you don't need to go back, but I'm just going to mention it because I highlighted it. In chapter 7, verse 16, 17, 19, 20, 23, 24, 27. And in chapter 8, in verse 29, 30, 33, and 36, for a total of 11 times, what is the phrase that you find as the last words in chapter 8? The house of God. It was all about the temple. It was all about the sacrifices. It was all about the king wanting to pay his tribute to whom? Yahweh, the God of the Jews. Now, he's probably spending equal amounts or maybe even more, because the Jews are a relatively small people, all over his kingdom. Artaxerxes is a very powerful man. He is an extremely wealthy man. And he's trying to buy favor with all the gods. He really paid for it. So, in his mind, the Jews are just another, you know, people. But Ezra does have the only true and living God's favor, so everything he does succeeds. So what we have is 1,772 men plus, you know, the women and children. But I think the big point of Ezra 8 is this fasting thing works. And it is kind of shameful, I think, among God's people today that we are so rarely involved in this. Surely we have problems that, you know, concern us, that interest us. It would rise to the level of, you know, causing us to think in terms of a fast. And so I'm always just trying to support that and to suggest that be good for us all. Okay, so then the provisions are handed over and appropriate sacrifices are offered. Okay, chapter 9, just a few verses here, the first four. When these things had been completed, the princes approached me saying, "The people of Israel and the priests and the Levites have not separated themselves from the peoples of the lands according to their abominations. The Canaanites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Jebusites, the Ammonites, the Moabites, the Egyptians, and the Amorites. They have taken some of their daughters for themselves and for their sons, so that the holy race has intermingled with the peoples of the lands. Indeed, the hands of the princes and the rulers have been foremost in this unfaithfulness. And when I heard about this matter, I tore my garment and my robe and pulled some of the hair from my head and my beard and sat down appalled." And he goes on at some great length. Let's read it. Verse 5. "The evening offering, I arose from my humiliation. Even with my garment and my robe torn, I fell on my knees, stretched out my hands to the Lord my God. I said, 'Oh my God, I am ashamed and embarrassed to lift up my face to you, my God, for our iniquities have risen above our heads. Our guilt has grown even to the heavens. Since the days of our fathers to this day, we've been in great guilt, and on account of our iniquities, we, our kings, our priests, have been given into the hand of the kings of the lands, to the sword, to captivity, to plunder, to open shame," as it is plunder, and to open shame, as it is this day. "But now, for a brief moment, grace has been shown from the Lord our God to leave us an escaped remnant, to give us a peg in his holy place, that our God may enlighten our eyes and grant us little reviving in our bondage. For we're slaves. Yet in our bondage, our God has not forsaken us, but has extended loving kindness to us in the sight of the kings of Persia, to give us reviving, to raise up the house of our God, to restore its ruins, to give us a wall in Judah, in all Jerusalem." And I'm not going to read all the rest of it, brethren. It's a beautiful prayer from a man who is devastated. In Ezra's case, I'm sure, brethren, he didn't pull out his hair as just a show. He wasn't literally pulling tufts out of his beard and making his head and chin bloody by it as a show. Where has he spent his whole life? Medo-Persia. What's he been studying his whole life? God's law. What does he come back to a homeland he's never seen carrying? Enormous amounts of silver and gold. He wants to come in and just have everything be perfect. And 3 days later, what's he find out? Well, you guys aren't even... Oh, it had to be just cataclysmic for this man with such high hopes, with such knowledge, with such purity, and to see these people failing at such a fundamental level, you know, jeopardizing their Messiah, you know, here in the promised land. It was just awful. So this prayer is a really great one. Not a lot of prayers in the Bible. This is a cool one. So there's the problem, and then chapter 9 is all about the prayer. We get the problem, we get the prayer. So guess what we're going to get in chapter 10? Well, it's the solution. We just read it. That's all we need to do, and we'll be done. Doesn't need a lot of comment. But while Ezra was praying and making confession, weeping and prostrating himself before the house of God, first time he's ever seen it, a very large assembly, men, women, and children gathered to him from Israel. For the people wept bitterly. Now, brother, right here, just think about this. How many people were upset to begin with? One guy. Is he long-established leader among them? New guy just hit town. But all he did was show proper remorse, horror at being unfaithful. And before the day ends, what has nothing more than his display of unhappiness at unfaithfulness, what has it done? It's created a crowd, a multitude. So they gather to him. And what are they doing at the end of verse 1? Weeping. Shechaniah, son of Jehiel, one of the sons of Elam, answered and said to Ezra, "We've been unfaithful to our God. We've married foreign women from the peoples of the land. Yet now there is hope for Israel in spite of this. So now, let us make a covenant with our God to put away all the wives and their children. According to the counsel of my Lord and of those who tremble at the commandment of our Lord, let it be done according to the law. Arise, for this matter is your responsibility, but we will be with you. Be courageous and act." In a matter of a few days, what did Ezra just become? A great leader among them. Now, he came with the king's letter. He came with a big offering. All that came with 1,772 people plus the women and children. But you don't just surrender to a guy and start casting off wives and children unless you have a pretty high regard for him. Him. And that he gained in a simple display of righteousness. Ezra rose in verse 5, made the leading priests, the Levites, and all Israel take oath that they would do according to this proposal. So they took oath. Now here's another thing to note. What was Ezra's suggestion that they should do in order to fix this great sin? It's a trick question. What did Ezra suggest they should do? Ezra suggested absolutely nothing. Ezra didn't suggest anything. Who did in verse 2? All Ezra did was weep and pray. A crowd gathered, and then one of them said, "There's still hope for us. Here's what I propose." Ezra said, "Okay, let's do that." Okay. So, brethren, what an amazing leader this guy is. He let them figure it out. They did. So, in 6, Ezra rose from before the house of God and went into the chamber of Jehohanan, son of Eliashib. Although he went there, he did not eat bread nor drink water. What's he doing? He's immediately fasting. He's mourning over the unfaithfulness of the exiles at the end of verse 6. Verse 7, they made a proclamation throughout Judah and Jerusalem to all the exiles. They should assemble at Jerusalem. Whoever would not come within 3 days, according to the council, the leaders, and the elders, all his possessions would be forfeited. He himself excluded from the assembly of the exiles. Has he got authority to do that? Right here in Aramaic, doesn't he? Anything else according to the law? He's got the king's letter in his hand. So in 9, all the men of Judah and Benjamin assembled at Jerusalem within 3 days. It was the 9th month, on the 20th of the month. All the people sat in the open square before the house of God, trembling because of this matter and the heavy rain. Amazing moment. Ezra the priest stood up and said to them, "You've been unfaithful and have married foreign wives, adding to the guilt of Israel. Now therefore, make confession to the Lord God of your fathers and do His will and separate yourselves from the peoples of the land and from the foreign wives." Then all the assembly answered and said with a loud voice, "That's right. As you've said, so it is our duty to do. But there are many people. It is the rainy season. We are not able to stand in the open, nor can the task be done in 1 or 2 days, for we've transgressed greatly in this matter. Let our leaders represent the whole assembly. Let all those in our cities who have married foreign wives come at appointed times, together with the elders and judges of each city, until the fierce anger of our God on account of this matter is turned away from us. Only Jonathan, son of Asahel, and Jaaziah, the son of Tikva, opposed this, with Meshulam and Shabbatai, the Levites, supporting them. But the exiles did so, Ezra, the priest, selected men, heads of fathers, of each of their father's household, all by name. They convened first day, 10th month, to investigate the matter. Finished investigating all the men who had married foreign wives by the first of the month. Among the sons of the priest were, and the rest of the chapter, save for the final verse, is just a very long list of unfaithfulness. And what woe to destroy these marriages, to send them all apparently back to their own people, to be cared for by their own people. They are cast out, wives and sons and daughters. 44. All these had married foreign wives. Some of them had wives by whom they had children. Okay? Now, this raises an awful lot of questions, I know. That's why I'm glad the bell's about to ring. This just seems like the cruelest thing. By our standards, you know, in or out of the church, the horrifying thing of this. You talk about cruelty and all of that. Okay, fine. But it was God's will. They broke it. Whose fault is this disaster? It is not God's. And you must never charge God with cruelty when somebody refuses to do what he tells them to do and then finds that they're in trouble because of it. They were disobedient. They needed to fix it. They knew what they had to do to fix it. Came up with that idea on their own. But to their everlasting credit, did they fix it? Next time you mess up, fix it. Okay, last defense.